Good morning, I'm Richard Adie. Welcome to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm glad you could join me for our Friday talkback. Today, a very big topic, food allergy and intolerance. And yes, there's a difference between those two, which we'll get to shortly. Whether you've got your own issues with food or you know someone who has, you probably haven't failed to notice that just about every second or third person, it seems, can't eat something nowadays. Primary schools proudly declare themselves nut-free, and birthday cakes to share with your class have all but disappeared in some of them. In fact, the sharing of any food at all is now discouraged. In the school my children go to, it's not supposed to happen at all. I should say right now that no one is disputing that some people have life-threatening food issues. But today we also want to explore whether the numbers affected are really as high as you might think they are. Are more people self-diagnosing? And is this leading to a general trend to trivialise the issue? In a moment, we'll get the latest on what's happening with the research and management of food allergy and intolerance. But I am keen to hear from you on this. The number to call is 1300 22 55 76. 1300 22 55 76. If it's easier to remember, 1300 call RN will get you through. If time differences mean you can't ring now, call the listener line on 02833 1430, and we're on Eastern Summer Time in the Life Matters studio, I have to remind you. There's also the Facebook page and the website. Comments are open there too. The website is abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. Now, with me in the studio to guide us in this discussion is Dr. Robert Lobley, the Director of the Allergy Unit at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney. He's a clinical immunologist with special interests in food intolerance, allergic disease, celiac disease, autoimmunity and chemical sensitivity. Between the lot of them, I think we're covered. Thanks for coming in, Rob.
You're welcome, Richard.
It's fair to say that most of your professional life has been spent in this field. What changes have you seen in this time?
Well, there's certainly been a big increase in food allergies, in allergic disease generally, and food allergies in particular. Food intolerances have always been there, but they've been hidden away and poorly understood. And I think what we've seen a big change in awareness and knowledge of intolerances as well.
Right. Well, let's go back a step. You said food allergies seem to be on the rise. And the peanut allergy, I suppose, is the one that we're all most aware of, because it's been most linked with anaphylaxis, where there can be terrible fatal consequences. Do we know what's caused this rise in this?
Well, there's been a general increase in allergic diseases over about 25 years, and there's a popular theory which is often referred to as the hygiene hypothesis, that is that kids are being raised in a more hygienic environment than they used to be a generation or so ago, and that because of that, the immune system isn't being kept busy fighting off germs and viruses. And so it's turned its attention to otherwise harmless things in the environment, such as allergens. But that doesn't really explain the rise in food allergy, which has been over about 15 years or so it first sort of came to notice. And it's been on steadily on the increase ever since. And it's, as you say, it's mainly nuts, peanut in particular.
Yes.
And nobody knows why that's happening.
No.
There may well have been a change in the way that people consume nuts compared to previous generations.
We probably consume more nuts than we ever have.
Probably consuming more, but maybe also consuming them in a different way. We suspect that people are snacking more than they used to be. It may also be one of the reasons for the increase in obesity.
Yes.
But the snacking behaviour means that there's a lot more nuts around in the home environment. There are more nuts generally available. And in recent years, because of the awareness of peanut allergy, we've seen a rise in allergy to other nuts. Cashew has now replaced peanut as the most common reason for admission with anaphylaxis to hospital.
All right. Well, we'll come. I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but something else has happened. Celiac disease is on the rise too. Now, celiac disease is not a food allergy, but like an allergy, it's an autoimmune response, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it's actually one of the more interesting crossovers between an allergy and an autoimmune response, because it's the first autoimmune disease where we've been able to identify an allergic trigger. So it's a different kind of allergy than the regular allergies to nuts, mm-hmm. But nevertheless, it is triggered off by exposure to gluten in the diet. Now, whether that's increased in prevalence is unclear. There's certainly a big increase in awareness and in diagnosis. There are a lot of people walking around the street with celiac disease who don't know it, but we have much better screening tests now, so they get more readily picked up.
I just saw a paper in the Medical Journal of Australia saying an estimated 4 out of 5 Australians with celiac disease are undiagnosed. Mm. So there's obviously a huge range of responses to
yes.
celiac disease.
Well, it's just often referred to as the celiac iceberg. We see the tip of the iceberg, yeah. but there's a lot beneath the surface.
One of my nieces ended up spending 6 weeks in hospital at Westmead, and eventually they worked out that celiac was the problem when yeah. she was quite little, and she was very ill.
Yeah.
But if 4 out of 5 people don't know they've got it, then they're clearly not very ill.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, what about food intolerances, because I need you to explain the difference between food intolerances and allergies, and I want to preface that by saying they can present in the same way.
They can. Well, it's difficult, but basically food allergies work through the immune system, so that a food protein triggers off an immune reaction. In the general type of allergic reaction, it's antibodies of what are called the IgE type, which stick onto cells that release histamine in the body. And so when they come into contact with the allergen, there's a sudden release of histamine, and that causes the acute allergic reaction.
Right.
Celiac disease is a different kind of allergy involving the T cells in the immune system, but they're both immune reactions. Intolerances have nothing to do with the immune system at all. They work in a completely different way. We suspect that they work by stimulating nerve endings in different parts of the body and causing irritation. And they're rather comparable to the way that drug side effects work. Different people are susceptible,
right.
can get a different range of symptoms. But one of the confusing things is that some people get hives and swelling from
which seems like it's an allergic response.
Exactly, which are exactly the same as the allergic hives and swellings. They work through the same cells that release the histamine,
yes.
but just through a different pathway.
Am I right in thinking, or am I wrong, and I'm often wrong, so go ahead, Rob, that allergies are more serious, more life-threatening, that essentially you're unlikely to die from a food intolerance?
I think that's correct, yes. Yes, even with people who get the hives and swellings, and they can sometimes be quite serious, death is extremely rare. Whereas with food allergies, deaths have been well documented, and so is a risk.
On Life Matters today, Friday Talkback, and we are talking about food intolerances and food allergies, and with me is an expert, Robert Loblay, Director of the Allergy Unit at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney, and we'll be talking to Robert a lot throughout the morning. I want to take the first quick caller of the day, actually. Teresa, hello.
Oh, hello. How are you?
I'm really well. You want to make a point about, well, chemicals and peanuts.
Yes, I do. These days now, we have so many chemicals used in growing our food, and China is known to use a lot of chemicals. I mean, the garlic, a lot of our garlic in our shops now in supermarkets does come from China, and a lot of chemicals are used to grow it.
So you think it's the chemicals?
Nobody seems to talk about the amount of chemicals that are used growing peanuts and where people buy their peanuts from. We've got organic peanut farmers in Australia, and quite frankly, we're better off buying from them, even though it is a bit more expensive, than buying from overseas and not knowing completely what chemicals are being used.
All right, thank you very much, Teresa. I'll put that to you, Rob. Is there anything in that? Because I know it's easy to see why Teresa is sure of it.
Yeah, no, look, it's a common concern that people have. And we looked into this some years ago. Interestingly, peanut people who use peanuts in food manufacturing source them from all over the world.
Yes.
And it varies from batch to batch. Sometimes they come from China, sometimes South America, sometimes elsewhere. It doesn't seem to make any difference where they come from as to how prone people are to get bad reactions to them. Having said that, there are chemicals in peanuts that can cause reactions in people with intolerances.
Yes.
These are natural chemicals, not additives.
Well, of course, I often feel that that additives have a bad name, and there is a tendency to assume that natural is good. And when I get into an argument with someone about this, and I do try not to, I always point out that funnel web venom is a natural compound, but not one that you want to have an encounter with.
No.
Last year, there was some review research that was reported on here. It was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, and it found that many more people think they have food allergies than actually do. In the US, they estimated it was between 2 and 10%. Up to 30% think they do. Why do you think that is?
Look, this has been a common problem in surveys of the community for as long as I've been in the field, because people in the community often use the word allergy to describe any bad reaction to something they've been exposed to.
Yes.
And for a long time, people used to talk about intolerances as food allergies. And when they answer surveys and questionnaires, they'll tick the box to say, yes, I've got an allergy.
Yeah, yeah.
When really, it's an intolerance. So there's been this confusion with the terminology that
in part because sometimes they can present in the same way.
In part, yes.
And in part because there's a kind of conflation of terms.
There is, yeah.
In Australia, the tradition when you've got a cold is to say, you know, oh, he's got the flu.
Yeah.
And he hasn't got the flu at all.
Yeah, and we've always been really fussy about educating people to use the right word. Otherwise, it confuses their doctors, it confuses everybody.
The researchers went on to speculate that this might lead to possible overdiagnosis, diagnoses, and even something they called the societal trivialization of food allergy. And I suppose I can see what they mean, which is if a huge percentage of the population thinks they've got a food allergy, then it becomes kind of something you don't have to almost, it's normalised.
Yes, there is another problem, which is with the testing, because the test for food allergies actually pick up the antibodies, but not everybody with an antibodies has a clinical allergy to the food. So people often get diagnosed on the basis of a positive test.
Yep.
When they're not really at risk of having a reaction to that food. So this complicates the whole diagnostic process.
No wonder people can get this wrong in such a big way. On Life Matters today, that's what we're talking about, food allergies and food intolerances. And with me is Dr. Robert Lobley. He's director of the allergy unit at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney. Want to hear from you. There are some lines available now, 1-300-22-55-76, or at least one line that I can see. But we want to take Anne now in New South Wales. Hello, Anne.
Hi, Richard.
You've got a food intolerance, I understand.
I have.
And, can you tell me what it is, or...?
Yes, I can. It came on me soon after I'd had a very big emotional upset, about 6 months or so. I started getting these terrible, terrible attacks, and one day I was at a conference and I was sitting in the audience. I had to leave and I went to the toilets and I thought I was going to die. I'd never experienced anything like it before.
Yes.
My whole body was really hot and I was eliminating at both ends.
Yes.
And
I get the picture.
You get the picture.
Yes.
So there we are. I mean, then it took me about 5 or 6 years to find out what it was.
What was it?
It was, I found RPA. And I found it because my daughter was sitting next to somebody at a dinner and she described what was happening for me because the whole family was worried.
Yep.
She said, oh, go to RPA. I've got that.
Right.
So I did. And it was fantastic. They put me on an elimination diet. It was food intolerance. And any time I feel that I might have overstretched myself on the sort of food that causes it...
Are you going to tell me what sort of food it is, or are you going to keep that to yourself?
Highly coloured foods. You know, strawberry jam is out.
Right.
Pear jam is in. They have supplies.
Jeez,
of
I think
pear
you,
jam
I
at the RPA centre.
I think that's unfortunate because if you can only eat one sort of jam, surely it's better to be able to eat strawberry
than
pear.
That's right. And you know, but I do eat these things that are bad for me, so to speak.
How long did it take to kind of go through the whole elimination thing? Because that is quite a process, isn't it?
It's a month.
Right.
A month.
Got to
you know,
motivate.
Beans are okay, Brussels sprouts are okay, you know, there are, and lettuce you have to, you know, the just one kind of lettuce is okay.
Right.
But, you know, I just watch it all the time now, so I don't punish myself with the whole elimination thing, but I just bless those people at RPA, and I wondered why all the surgeons and the physicians and everybody I went to see, we did tests and everything for 5 or 6 years and never discovered what was going on.
Good.
Until by accident we did. Now, I don't know other people who've got this, but I do think that the medical profession should really understand. I'm a very allergic person anyway. I mean, our whole family.
Now, you're conflating the two again, Anne.
No, I'm not. I'm not.
Because intolerances and allergies are not the same. We've just been hearing
that's
that.
True. You're right, Richard. And I've lived with, you know, eczema and hay fever and all those sort of things with the whole family.
I'm a bit like that too.
Yeah, but we live with that and we learn to live with that. But when this came on me and I was about 60 when that happened, and out of the blue.
And I've got a full board. So, but you've been great. Thanks very much for that. I want to keep moving. Elizabeth, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty well. Now, what have you
fascinating
found?
Fascinating listening to Anne because she sounds so much like me, although my particular intolerances are different and have a different effect.
Well, what are they?
But I am also an allergic person. I can't eat solanum, that's tomato, potato, capsicum, eggplant and almost all bush tucker foods.
Right.
And, or citrus.
Right. Is this an intolerance or
yes, it's
an intolerance?
My allergies are quite different and I've coped with them since I was a baby.
So how did you find out that you had the intolerance?
Again, by accident. I was in my local library borrowing something else and I trawled along the shelf and I found a funny little book, funny looking little book about arthritis.
Yep.
I borrowed it and it listed in order the foods most likely to contribute to arthritic pain. So I decided to go off the top two and an alternative person told me to go off them for 3 months.
Yes.
He said, there's no test. I can't test you. Go off them for 3 months. Then eat, if you feel better, it might be because you're off those or it might be because the weather changed. So you have to put them back on your diet and see what happens. So I did that.
How long did it all take?
Well, 3 months off them.
Yep.
And then I started eating them again, just gradually.
Yep.
And the excruciating pain in my right shoulder returned.
Right. So have you been officially medically diagnosed?
Well, it's recognised that I have arthritis, yes.
No, I meant of the intolerances.
No, there's no sort of way of doing it, apparently.
Oh, right. Okay, that's interesting,
isn't it? You can't inject tomato into your... I suppose you could inject solanum into your system, I don't know. I haven't bothered because it works.
I don't want to encourage anyone to do that at home today, Elizabeth.
What,
thank you very much. Yes, inject solanum. Thank you very much. I want to take another call, then we'll keep moving. That's Elizabeth in Victoria. Polly, hello.
Oh, hi, Richard.
Now, you want to talk about your nephew.
I want to tell you about my nephew, who's now 16.
Mm-hmm.
But about 3.5 years ago, he was at school. He'd eaten peanut butter from, you know, when he was quite small.
Yes.
And one day at school with his 13-year-old friends, one of them wiped a peanut butter sandwich on his face at lunchtime. And he just sort of went, you know, laughed and wiped it off.
Yeah.
Went into class and his whole side of his face swelled up and they rushed him off and EpiPens and things.
Crikey.
And he was found to be, I think it's to do with chemicals because he had not been allergic. And then at 13, they said if he'd eaten that peanut butter sandwich, they wouldn't probably have got him to the EpiPen in time.
Thank you, Paul.
It was so dramatic.
I'm going to put that to Rob Lobley, who we have with us. Have you heard of that kind of thing before, Rob?
I've certainly heard of really bad reactions from, touching the skin with peanut. But
this sudden onset, being able to eat peanut butter before all of a sudden, bang.
Look, that's very unusual. It happens.
Yep.
Mostly people in whom those sort of allergies come on with peanut later in life, in their teens, don't have it as badly as the kids who develop it earlier in life. And it may well be that this particular person had an undiagnosed allergy that had been lurking there for a while.
Okay, thanks for that, Polly. One more, I think, and then we'll keep moving. Kelly from Victoria.
Oh, hello.
You've got a question.
I do. I've got food allergies and intolerances, and I've had tests since I was about 14 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I'm now 36.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been on various elimination diets and for many years, and the most success I've ever had in working out what foods I'm intolerant to is an IgG test, and I know it's controversial, but I was just wanting to ask your visitor whether, how valid these tests
Rob,
are.
What do you reckon?
They're not valid.
Oh, okay. Is there, because Kelly's in Victoria, obviously she can't get up to Royal Prince Alfred in Sydney, is there somewhere in Victoria that's equivalent to what you do?
Oh, yeah, there's some clinics down there and some specialists who are familiar with the testing process for food intolerances.
Have you tried any of that, Kelly?
I've actually followed the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital's Friendly Food Guide,
yes.
And I've done the elimination diet.
Right.
I sort of stuck to the low natural chemical diet for a long time, and what I've found is I've developed intolerances to a lot of the foods that are apparently low chemical, because I've had them for so much that I've developed intolerances to them.
Mm.
So I've found that I had these tests done that were intradermal, just because I'm sort of desperate to find out what it is, because I have chronic eczema to the point where I've been hospitalised a few times with it. So I did try this test, and it sort of indicated that I was allergic to rice, and there was a few other grains that I'd been eating a lot of on the low chemical diet. And when I did actually cut them out, the specialist told me, cut them out, you can't ever be sure with these tests. So I cut them out, and my skin improved. Within a week, my skin was improved. So I know it's a controversial area in allergy.
But if it's, you feel it's working for you?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
I've never had relief from my eczema for forever. So.
All right. Okay, Kelly, thank you very much for that. That's an interesting story. I want to hear, and if you're trying to get through, we do really have a chock-a-board now. So let me urge you to the listener line, 02-833-1430. 02-833-1430. We'll get as many of your responses to air as we can next week. You can also post on the Facebook page, where we're very easy to find. If you're on Facebook, you can't miss us, really. Now, I want to hear from someone who deals with other people's food allergies on a daily basis. Alex Herbert's the executive chef and co-owner of Bird Cow Fish, which is a bistro in the heart of Sydney's Surry Hills restaurant strip. And you might have seen her on Ready Steady Cook, which is a TV show on Channel 10, where she's been known to turn out many delicious dishes as well. And now, as well as her professional role, Alex is also mother to a boy with severe food allergies, and she joins me now from the restaurant where she's getting ready for lunch service. Hello, Alex. I appreciate your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Good morning. How are you?
I'm really well. What are the most common food issues you're asked to work around?
Generally, the ones we get in the restaurant are food intolerances, people with celiac intolerances, and seafood.
Right.
It's a big one. We actually don't come across that much peanut, which is interesting because that's what my son suffers from, and he also suffers from egg intolerance, or actually an allergy to eggs.
Right.
So, but yeah, it seems to be more the seafood and the wheat that we have to avoid.
Now, I imagine that creates a bit of extra work, and I'm thinking, despite all the planning, professional kitchens are very high-pressure, busy places. I mean, can you imagine? Is it easy for cross contamination?
It's incredibly easy, and this is what is the problem is that it's very difficult to suddenly stop and say, okay, well, has that got this in it or that got that in it if someone's saying they can't eat certain ingredients. And so we've developed a food information form that we use for mostly for our large bookings, because that's when we can send it out. So if we've got a functional party, so we send it out to the organisers and ask them to send it to everyone that they've invited so that we can be alerted beforehand.
Yep.
And that way we can know further down the preparation chain that if we need to make something especially for this person that's, you know, without certain ingredients, then we can safely do it, which we can't do like at 7:30 on a Saturday night.
No, indeed. Well, at work, at least you've got systems.
Yes, indeed.
You also deal with this at home. Your 11-year-old boy has the allergies you mentioned. I think it's eggs and nuts.
Eggs and peanuts, but I just classify that as nuts because I just know that wherever peanuts are stored is generally where other nuts are stored, so I kind of just eliminate that whole risk by just saying no nuts.
Some kids grow out of this, or seem to.
Some fortunate children do. Not mine.
Right, okay.
Not mine.
I know it can go the other way too.
It seems to be going the other way with Joel, yes, definitely.
And I know because I have some of my best friends, they have two boys and one of them does have the peanut allergy and he has to have the EpiPen with him.
Yep.
I know that if we go out to dinner with just the parents,
yep,
they want to go Asian because...
Oh, because they can't.
Because
ordinarily.
They can't at home. So it affects the whole family, doesn't it?
Oh, it does affect the whole family. I mean, nothing like it affects the individual. I mean, not a day goes by without my son saying he wished he wasn't allergic, either because he's got a runny nose or because of his eczema or because someone's brought cakes to school that he couldn't eat, even though we supply alternate things for those instances. So, yeah, it's missing out on food, but it's also just the whole emotional side of missing out on something that is basically sort of taken for granted by the rest of the population.
The thing with the cake at school, I'm all for fruit. I love it, and it's good that kids eat it. But a fruit plate is no substitute for a cake.
Oh, look, you know, I mean, there's certain foods that are associated with being a bit naughty and having a good time, and that applies to young children as much as it applies to adults going out to dinner and having a few extra glasses of wine. So there's sort of, you know, there's those sorts of things that sort of have to be considered. And, you know, my son... You know, there's certain chips that he can eat and there's certain chocolates that he can eat, although, of course, you know, these things change all the time. You know, like just recently Nestle had Aero Bars, which were previously deemed free of peanuts, that have suddenly, now they've changed. And that's the other thing that, you know, I have to constantly, just this week, talking to Joel about and saying, you know, just because something was safe last week doesn't mean it's safe this week. And you have to be really quite vigilant about making sure when you pick up that packet at the supermarket, just to check that nothing's changed in terms of either where it's packaged or produced.
Okay, so he's 11.
He's 11.
He's going to go into adolescence pretty soon.
Yep.
Adolescence is associated with risk-taking behaviour.
Yep.
And poor assessment of risk. You can't be with him, and he won't want you with him all the time.
No, well, he's going to school camp on Monday for 3 days.
Right.
So school camps are really, like, even before we get to adolescence, I can't be with him all the time. So I sort of have the...
You've made all his food, haven't
I've
you?
I've made all his food.
Yes.
Pretty much.
But you can't do that forever.
No, I can't do that forever. And he's incredibly responsible and aware because this is virtually something that he was born with. So I've pretty much brainwashed him, the poor thing, from day one. That, you know, and all his teachers always say, wow, you know, he's really conscious of it and very careful. It's going to get more complicated for sure.
You're a big supporter of Anaphylaxis Australia and they've been doing a lot of work on eating out safely, haven't they?
They have, yeah, especially in the last 12 months or so. And it's a really, I mean, I've talked to Maria Said about this and it's really complex because, you know, when I go to eat out with Joel, it's one thing to ask a restaurateur, okay, my child suffers from, you know, these allergies, can you make sure you use a fresh board and what oil is in your fryer and all those sorts of things. And it's great when they understand and can come back to you with the true answers. There's just, the problem is, and this is why the work that Anaphylaxis Australia are doing is so good, is that it's about educating the food service that, you know, what they think is safe, they might not understand that the hand that the chef used, you know, to grab, you know, the peanuts for the dish an hour ago,
yes,
may still be the same hand that picks up that piece of meat to pan fry in a clean pan with fresh tongs, but there's still been that connection between,
yes,
safe and unsafe food products. So my biggest concern is when someone says, yes, no, we understand that's safe, do they really know? And what sort of, you know, how far do you trust that knowledge? And that's why, you know, this sort of education program is so important, because we really need to get that through.
Well, you're about to front a community announcement for them as well, I understand.
Yes, next week we're filming a community service.
Making this sort of point, or...?
They're interviewing a few people. It's more about just constantly reminding people that there is a really big difference between someone not wanting to eat something, mm-hmm, and someone coming in saying, oh, you know, can you leave the cheese out of this, or, you know, can I not have that? And people saying, oh, you know, a little bit won't hurt, to a little bit could kill them.
Yes, there is rather a big difference there.
There's a really big difference, and I mean, that's the bottom line. It's like, you know, it can be a life and death issue.
It can. Alex, I know you've got lunch service to sort out. Thank you very much for joining us.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Alex Herbert, executive chef, co-owner of Bird Cow Fish, and anxious mum about to pack her young son off to camp. Good to get that professional perspective, I think. I've got a couple of things to read from the website, then we'll go back to Rob Loblay, who's my guest throughout this morning. Alan says, being a vegetarian, it's never safe to eat out. I may be lucky and have a choice of two main courses. If I ask for a main and request the meat taken out, well, the looks of derision and questioning are the norm. I do not trivialise what I put in my mouth, but it's not easy to have good food without resorting to an old lettuce leaf. And David says eating out can be a problem for my wife and myself. My wife cannot have anything fermented or with fungi, and I cannot have much chilli or raw red onion. Almost all restaurants we visit at home or away oblige if you let them know when placing a meal order, but we have to remember to ask. I have noticed, and this is kind of, I think, a sort of sidebar issue, that the older I get, some of the foods that I love, they don't love me back. So red meat, I can't eat much red meat now. Or if I do, I feel very unwell afterwards for a couple of days. It's the same with blue cheese. I have to be careful with red wine. So some of the, you know, bacchanalian delights that I had as a younger man, and it's probably a good thing now that I'm a middle-aged man, are no longer open to me. We'll get back to your calls in a minute, but I have with me Rob Loblay from the Allergy Unit at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney. And there's a couple of things, I think, to talk to him about. When someone does discover you and comes in, how do you work out whether they have an allergy or an intolerance?
Well, first of all, it's by clinical assessment, because the symptoms of an allergy are pretty distinct. And if people don't have those symptoms, but they have other symptoms, it's not likely to be an allergy. So if they don't get the rashes, the swelling, the anaphylaxis, those sorts of things, or the eczema, then almost certainly that they don't have an allergy as such. And we would focus on the intolerances. If we're not sure, if they are not sure and they want to know for sure, we'll do skin tests on them, which pick up the antibodies that are present in people who've got allergies.
Right, if the antibodies, is where they prick up your arm.
Exactly, yeah. And if the antibodies are negative, if the skin tests are negative, that's very strong evidence that it's not an allergy.
That it's an intolerance.
Yeah. Right. Well, it may be an intolerance.
Right.
Then it becomes a question of testing the diet, yes.
And that's when you go on the elimination cycle.
Exactly. Yes.
Which is long and you have to be motivated.
You do. I tell people it's dull, boring, antisocial, and you've really got to want to do it.
I have to ask you about schools, because I think it's quite common now in primary schools that there are no nuts. There's a no-nut policy. And certainly at my children's school, and I think this is quite normal too, children are very much, are told they're not to share foods or swap foods. And certainly in some schools, they discourage you from taking a cake in on the birthday. And actually, recently we went through this with my daughter, who's in year two, so her third year of school. And I think it was a Saturday, and she was having a peanut butter sandwich, which she loves. And she said, why can't I have this at school? And we talked about it. We support the school's nut policy. But in America, and this may be an only in America thing, it's been recently reported that some parents at a school in Florida want a child with a severe peanut allergy taken out of school They think she should be taught at home. It's too dangerous for her to be there. This isn't her parents. It's the parents of the other kids.
Mm.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
Mm, it is.
Right, let's have some more of your calls and then back to Rob Lobley. Let's take Polly in Victoria, because you have a question about peanut allergy, don't you, Polly?
Good morning. I read somewhere a little while ago that the peanuts that they're using to make peanut butter now is one type of peanut that has more of the chemical that is part of the allergy reaction.
All right, Rob. Could that be... That sounds...
Look, it's almost right, but the issue with peanut is that the allergenicity of the nut protein, that is, its tendency to cause an allergic reaction, depends on how it's prepared, in particular the roasting temperature.
Yep.
So roasted peanuts are much more allergenic than raw peanut, and the higher the roasting temperature, the more likely they are to provoke an allergic reaction, or the more severe it is.
So,
and it's sort of interesting because the roasting temperature probably influences the flavour.
Yes.
Okay, and I suspect that the manufacturers are trying to get a little bit of market advantage by increasing the flavour, by roasting it at slightly high temperature, and so they're upping the ante all the time.
That could address it, Polly.
Yeah, I did actually also hear that in the past they used a whole range of peanuts, different sort of varieties.
Yeah.
But now this particular one is a high producer, so they're only using the one. And I guess it makes me think about monocultures as well, and whether there's something in that with how many allergies we are finding now in our communities.
Good points, Polly. Thank you. I'm going to keep moving, if you'll excuse me, just because the board is very full. Kate in Tasmania. Now, you want to talk about what Rob and I were just touching on, which is the kids' lunchbox at school.
Mm, that's right. We moved to Tasmania about 4 years ago. We'd previously been living in the ACT. My kids went to school there, and it was always really interesting because the school had such tight policies about allergies and what you could take in their lunchbox, and you know, they micromanaged some of the classrooms. So if there was a kid in a particular class and everybody in that class didn't take peanut butter sandwiches or whatever along, so you know, it was really well organised. And you know, if you put your kid out for a play date or a party or something like that, all the mums always sort of say, well, you know, does your kid have any allergies? And everybody was very aware. And then we moved here, and the first thing we noticed was that when you had the kids over for play dates, nobody asked, oh, is your child allergic to anything? And everybody looked sort of a bit oddly at me, because I'd say, oh, you know, Holly's allergic to peanuts. So, you know, don't give her peanut sandwiches for lunch and whatever. And, you know, it was a real oddity. And even the school, they didn't have a much when we first moved here about awareness of allergies. In fact, none of the kids except my kids seemed to have any allergies at all. Well, I guess that was brought home a while ago. They had their musical production at school. They were having a sort of a banquet to go along with it, the kids. And I wrote on the permission note, you know, Holly can't have peanuts, and no comment came back or no information further about the food. And she basically survived the night by eating crackers and missing out and everything, because she didn't know if anything had peanuts in it. And you know, we were really struck by the difference in approach and attitude. And I guess it prompted me to think, does anybody map where allergies are located by, you know, geographical location?
That's a good question.
Some areas that have more types of one allergy than another.
That's a good question, and I'll put it to Rob in a moment. But what I'm thinking, Kate, is for your daughter, the social side of it. I don't like the idea of her going to this thing and having to eat crisps.
No, I think she was quite put out, because she loves all sorts of different foods, and she'll eat all sorts of things that nobody else her age will eat. And, but she didn't, I mean, it's only a mild allergy, but she didn't want to be sick in front of her peers. And I was a bit sort of cross that in a way she was excluded.
Has there been any change since you've been there?
Well, we did get a note home the other day saying that they're updating their files on student allergies. So maybe there's a growing awareness or a growing number of kids with allergies.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right. Thanks for that, Kate. I should put that to Rob. Do we know anything about the geographical distribution of allergies? Is there
not of specific allergies to particular foods? It seems to be the same pretty much wherever you go.
Yes.
But there is a very interesting relationship between latitude and prevalence of allergies, so that in the northern latitudes in the northern hemisphere and southern in the southern hemisphere, where there's less sunshine, there seems to be a higher prevalence of allergies generally and to food allergies as well.
Ah, this would tie in with something I read recently about winter babies in the northern hemisphere in particular having a greater prevalence to it because of the vitamin D.
Exactly. It's for the sunshine and vitamin D, it not only predisposes to autoimmune disease, but also to allergic disease.
Right, okay. I'm just processing the fact that I was born in January in England, which is the middle of winter, and I'm always sneezing my head off. Anyway, I want to keep moving. We'll talk to John in Victoria, and then we'll talk to Pam Housenlodge, who's author of Oscar's Lunchbox. This is about food intolerances. But let's talk to John briefly. Hello, John.
Yes, so good morning. I just wanted to ask Rob if there was any crossover between celiac disease and wheat intolerance, because my wife was tested negative for celiac disease but has very typical symptoms, and whenever she challenges herself, she gets the symptoms back, but her biopsy was negative. So has she got celiac disease or has she got a wheat intolerance?
I'm sure you're reluctant to actually diagnose over the phone, Rob, but go ahead.
No. If her biopsy was negative and she was eating wheat at the time of the biopsy or leading up to it, then it's a pretty reliable indication that she does not have celiac disease.
But she could have gluten intolerance.
But she could have gluten intolerance or wheat intolerance, and that's probably more common than celiac disease in the community at large, and it mainly occurs in people who've got irritable bowel syndrome.
So it can make you miserable.
Yep.
Yeah. Does that clear things up a bit, John?
Well, look, she's wonderfully better on her gluten-free diet.
Yeah.
And we don't really mind what the diagnosis is. We're just glad she's better.
Yeah. Thanks very much for giving us a ring. Right. I want to talk to Pam Housenlodge now. She's written a book called Oscar's Lunchbox, and it addresses those issues of food issues for kids, and especially intolerances. Hello, Pam.
Good morning, Richard.
Now, you wrote this book based on your own family experience, didn't you?
That's exactly right. My son, Emmett, I realised he had food intolerances when he was only 3 months old, and we identified that he was reacting to the chemicals in my breast milk. And through the Friendly Foods book from the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, I went on an elimination diet, and he went from waking every 2 hours to sleeping 13 hours straight. So that was a huge difference. But of course, we spent a lot of time obviously working out what he was intolerant to, but for me, there was a lot of resources out there to provide practical support for these kids, but I realised that the emotional challenge of having a food tolerance was equally as challenging.
That's it. I mean, and it's also going to depend on the kid, isn't it? Especially between, I don't know, how old is he now?
Well, he's 8 now, so it's changed a little bit. I think the hardest time for these kids is when they're kind of starting to move into playing with their friends a lot, going to friends' houses.
So from about 4?
Birthday parties. Yeah, so from about 4 to about 7 is kind of the trickiest time. When they turn, my son now, you can rationalise with him a bit more. But of course, he will also choose now to eat food that he shouldn't, and he also knows that he can feel the consequences of that.
Right, okay. So, but that's at least it's a mindful decision. Now, the book features the boy Oscar discovering that his own lunchbox looks pretty different to some of the other kids in the playground, and kind of dealing with that.
That's right. Well, Mum kind of, he comes home so distraught, and I wish I didn't have food intolerances. And Mum says, well, you know, the food in your lunchbox is the best food for your body. And she says, you just need to learn to read the messages and you can find your own special formula. And through a journey of working out what doesn't feel good and what does feel good, he realises that if he just listens to the messages from his body, he can find his own special race car. And at that moment where he goes, I'm lucky, I can actually feel this, I know, you kind of get a sense that Oscar becomes empowered. So instead of it being something that, seeing it as something that he's missing out on all the time, he takes control and he feels a lot better about his lunchbox.
Now, I'm wondering, Pam, because a few years ago we were out for dinner with friends and one of their boys, they don't like him having tomato and stuff like that because of behavioural issues.
That's right.
And I said, this is me, blundering in, I said, are you sure about that? I mean, it sounds very odd and all this. And my friend, who is a dear woman and she's fantastic, she got quite irate with me, and fair enough too, actually, in the circumstances. So it occurs to me that you have to, if you're in this position, that you might have a few arguments.
You do. And, you know, when I first, because Emmett is one of the growing number of kids who are intolerant to salicylates and amines, which are in most of our fruit and vegetables, or high levels are in a lot of the tastier fruit and vegetables, it took me a long time to kind of say, to digest that my kid couldn't eat fruit and veg that I'd been told my whole life would be good for me. And of course, when I would say that to other people, they would look at me like, what are you talking about? But, you know, if anyone's seen my son, and he can have the same reaction to a yellow lollipop as he does to a nectarine in terms of his behaviour.
So this has changed your life, life a bit.
It has, and you know what, I actually kind of have been able to look at it as a bit of a blessing and say, well, you know, we were all probably, not that we ate unhealthily, but we all had a reasonable amount of processed food in our diet, and having to work with Emmett's diet has meant that we've taken all of that out, and we're all much healthier for it. So, yeah, it's been a great opportunity for us to learn to eat better.
You now do your best to make and I think even sell yummy cakes to disprove that the food... That food without some things in it, it doesn't need to be boring.
Well, that's exactly right. And for me, it's always been about inclusiveness. So I really fought against that sense. I'm a wedding cake decorator, and I hated hearing a bride say, well, yes, I'll make one little cake for you and everyone else can eat your cake. And I thought that's really unfair. So I've worked really hard to make sure that everybody can eat something and it tastes really good. And one of the most empowering moments of Emmett's life was when we had some friends come to visit and their kids in the morning wanted his breakfast, which was rice porridge with goat's milk.
Right.
And they really enjoyed it. And Emmett must have grown 2 foot that day.
Ah, that would have been great to see. Pam, thank you very much for joining us today.
That's all right. My pleasure.
That's Pam Housenlodge. She is author of Oscar's Lunchbox, and you'll find out, which is out this week, actually, and you'll find details on the website abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Can I ask you, Rob, while I've got you here, that issue of behaviour, and people talk about hyperactivity and stuff like that, that my friend and their son have been through, and that Pam alluded to a bit, I think, and you hear it a bit, that's scientifically robust?
It is scientifically documented. Mm. How robust is still a bit unclear.
It's still debated.
It is debated, but it's very clear that there are certainly kids who do get behavioural reactions to chemicals in the food. That's very clear. It sort of first emerged in the 60s and 70s with Feingold. You may remember the Feingold diet.
Mm-hmm. I do. I remember the name, but I don't remember the diet.
Which was for hyperactivity.
Right.
And even though it did sort of encompassed the natural chemicals as well as the additives, everybody focused on the additives, and it caused an enormous controversy in America with the food companies. And then it all died away for a while, and recently, in the last few years, it's re-emerged with some studies in the UK which appear to have substantiated what Feingold was claiming.
Right.
Yeah.
But importantly, it's natural foods as well as additives.
As well, yes.
I want to take a call or two now before we wrap things up with my guest, Rob Lobley, from the Allergy Unit at RPA in Sydney. Temni in New South Wales, you've got a question, a very practical question, actually. Hello.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to ask Dr. Lobley his opinion about when babies should start solids. I do volunteer work as a volunteer breastfeeding counsellor, and we follow this advice from the World Health Organization that babies should have breast milk until they're 6 months old, but you often hear mothers say that their doctors have told them that they should be starting solids earlier to help prevent allergies, and they're get quite confused about it.
Yeah, okay, well, let's put it to Rob, because I've heard different things on this.
There's two separate issues. First is when to start solids, and that's true. That's the WHO recommendation, 6 months. But that's sort of mainly aimed at the developing world. And in our community, generally, the recommendations are 4 to 6 months.
Yep.
And, you know, see what the baby will accept.
If the baby is going, watching you eat and kind of making chewing motions, I mean, I remember my mum saying, I think he's ready to start solids.
And regardless of what recommendations are made, parents will do it anyway.
Yes.
Yeah? There's a separate issue about what you should do to prevent allergies. That's a hugely controversial issue at the moment. Nobody knows the answer, and I don't think I can really help with that.
I'm sorry we can't quite clear that up, Timney. Thanks very much for that.
Okay, thank you.
Let's take Robin in the ACT. Hello, you've got a soy allergy?
Yes, I do, and I think it's causing the eosinophilic esophagitis, which I have, which is another new disease that apparently is increasing, there's an increasing rate of it. And I was just wondering if the doctor might be able to have a little bit of a say about that.
Pretty quickly, Rob.
Yes.
Look, it's a fascinating issue. It's a particular type of allergic disease which has been recently recognised. Whether it's increasing or not, nobody knows.
Right. This is some inflammation of the esophagus.
Inflammation of the esophagus, but it can go down into the stomach and the small bowels as well in some people. But now that people are having more endoscopies where they look down into
the esophagus. Yeah.
It's more readily diagnosed and more often picked up.
So you're off the soy now, Robin?
Yes, which is really hard because soy is in just about anything that's commercially made.
Thank you very much for that. Sorry we couldn't...
No, that's fine.
But anyway, I want to take one more and then we'll wrap things up with Rob Loblay. Gail, in northern New South Wales, how are you going?
I'm well, how are you?
I'm well. Now, you work in hospitality, so you have to deal with this.
I do. I have to deal with it on a daily basis. And it can be really difficult, but it mostly depends on the customer's attitude, I've found. If they're not necessarily apologetic, but if they're understanding and say, look, I'm really sorry, I'm gluten intolerant, or I have these issues, or little Johnny, you know, can't have dairy or whatever, if they're understanding, then it makes life so much easier. But when you get people who are dogmatic and cranky and frustrated that, you know, you've only got two different gluten-free choices on the menu, it just makes it really difficult to sort of be friendly, to be nice, to serve them and to help them. It's really, it can be hard. So attitude, I mean, I've got allergies and intolerances myself, so I understand. But yeah, if people can be understanding of how difficult it is in hospitality to get everything right, like Alex Herbert was saying, it is so tricky, especially in a busy little cafe.
Well, good luck with it, Gail.
Thank you.
Depends where you are, I think, in northern New South Wales as to how much you're going to encounter that. I'll say nothing else on that score. That was Gail. She's our last caller of the day, I think. But a couple to put to Rob Loblay, who's been with us, kind enough to be with us out throughout this morning, and he's director of the allergy unit at RPA in Sydney. Correct labelling of food. This is an issue that we're still working on, isn't it? But it's got to be vital.
It is vital. It's very important. With the allergens, there's now good regulations about labelling. It covers the main, most common food allergies. There are emerging allergies, for example, to lupin, where dangerous reactions have occurred, which are not yet required to be labelled, and that's an emerging area.
Yes.
With the additives, we found it very helpful to have the numbering system, because once we know which things a person is sensitive to, we can give them a list of the numbers to look out for. That's been extremely helpful.
So what's your advice to someone who suspects they may have an issue with a particular food?
Well, I guess they should see their doctor first and make sure that they don't have some other serious problem. And if the doctor thinks, well, maybe, yes, it is a food problem, then there will be somebody in their local area that they could refer to have further investigation.
Do you only see the worst cases, or...?
Oh, no, I think we see the whole lot across the board.
All right. So, well, if you're in and around Sydney, RPA is where Rob Loblay is, the allergy unit. There. Thank you very much for joining me today, Rob.
Great pleasure.
I'm sure we're going to get a huge response. We certainly had a full board nearly all morning, and I think people will have a lot to say on this. So thank you for joining me. And thank you for, if you got through, great. If you didn't, I'm sorry. There's only so much we can do in the time we have. Let me urge you to the listener line. It's 02-833-1430. You can leave a message there. You can continue. You can find a lot more information, actually, on the website, which is abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. And you can continue the conversation there, too, as you can on Facebook. We're on Facebook. It's very easy to find us. I'd like to thank today's producer, Jackie May. Our sound engineer is Lila Schooner. Coming up next on ABC Radio National, it's The Book Show, and today it features Blue Skies, the neglected and just republished first novel of Australian writer Helen Hodgman. Now, on Monday's show, Monday's Life Matters, men talk about the impact of losing a baby on them. Much of the focus is on the mother, of course, but we're going to meet some men who have a bit to say on this as well. And the winner of MasterChef last year, Adam, you might remember him, on his food philosophy, plans for the future. I'm Richard Adie. It's been a pleasure. Have a good weekend. The news is coming up next.